Hello, and welcome to the podcast edition of Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, your source for news, reviews, previews, and interviews with baseball writers and authors, artists and musicians, filmmakers, basically anyone who has anything to do with baseball and pop culture. Because that's our slogan. If it fits on a bookshelf, it fits here. Very little grass grows under Lonnie Wheeler's feet. His second most recent title, Intangible, The Subtle Things That Win Baseball Games, was released on August 11th. And less than 2 months later, we have Pitch by Pitch, My View of One Unforgettable Game, the third book he has done with Hall of Famer Bob Gibson. Over his long career, Wheeler's covered people, such as Hank Aaron and Mike Piazza, places, like Wrigley Field, home of the Chicago Cubs, and things. I guess intangible counts as a thing. And it's always entertaining and educational when I have a chance to talk with him on his latest work and the next project to come. Lonnie Wheeler, welcome back to the Baseball Bookshelf.
Thanks, Ron. Appreciate you having me.
So you must be getting a bit of blowback from the sabermetric community on this one.
A little bit, and I expected that. And I actually went to great lengths in the book to point out that this was not any kind of assault on sabermetrics whatsoever, because I subscribe to sabermetrics and think they've enlightened the game enormously and stupendously, really. The point here with intangibles is that what is measurable and applicable to the value of a player is not 100% of the picture. It's probably somewhere in the 90s. It's a major portion of it, and it certainly gives you the baseline for a player's value. But there is some extra room there. There's a zone. Some people say it's what's occupied by luck, or whatever's undefinable. It's the margin of error, the difference between the sabermetric, the analytic expectation, and the reality. That field, that area, is what I think is occupied by the unseen qualities, the intangibles that a player brings to the table.
Where do intangibles come from? Where do players learn that sort of thing?
I think a couple things. Coaching, watching and listening to games. Many, color commentators on national and local television are very sensitive to those things, and they're always talking about them. I think that it's also values that are ingrained in us, not just in baseball, but in terms of conduct and behavior, and behaving right, acting right. Those virtues, we like to think, have an effect. They're not just pie in the sky. They're not just an abstract that goes nowhere. But on baseball field, we can see them in action, and the hope is that they make a difference in the standings and with your ball club. The kind of players we like to root for are the ones, many people won't speak for everybody, but players who do things right, who play hard, who hustle and support their teammates, it makes it easier to root for those guys, and all the while hoping and trusting that those things do make a difference. But I think most of us grow up with that kind of ethos.
Now, your book is mostly about the Cincinnati Reds, which is your team. I'm thinking of my team, the New York Mets, who just at the trading deadline acquired several players who are contributing both on and off the field. Yoenis Cespedes obviously is having an MVP caliber run. Juan Uribe, Kelly Johnson, and some of those players are injecting life, I think is the phrase that the broadcasters like to use, into a clubhouse that might have been a little dormant. And of course you have the return of their captain, David Wright, who they're always showing going over to a player, putting an arm around his shoulder, whispering in his ear, things of that nature.
There are just so many ways a player can contribute. Even if a certain player, say, doesn't, by all accounts, possess the full set of intangibles, but brings an energy and a confidence, a record of success, that can be a communicable thing on the team in terms of their confidence and their expectation. I believe a team's expectation has an effect on its outcome. And the tricky part about it and what makes this study so complicated is that it's such a fluid formula that a player you may fit in well and make a big difference on in one clubhouse with one set of personalities, but put that same player with all the qualities he brings to bear, put him in another clubhouse that either already has those qualities or is not sensitized to them, and maybe he has, you know, very little effect. You know, bringing up the Mets, one of the most provocative examples to me is Keith Hernandez. He was obviously an excellent player in St. Louis. He was a co-MVP, a great fielder, you know, very efficient with the bat, a talented fundamental hitter, and yet the Cardinals, Whitey Herzog, wanted him gone. In Whitey's book, he talked about even one of the coaches saying that Hernandez was poisoning the club, and Whitey criticized him for not hustling and apparently not caring. Wanted him gone because Whitey was very big on the culture of the clubhouse and the team. Sent him over to the Mets, and Frank Cashin received him immediately and told him that he would like him to be a leader in that clubhouse on that team, and he was. Having been what they described as poison in St. Louis, suddenly he was magic in New York with the Mets and became a leader, became the guy that everybody looked up to, identified as the example of playing the game right way. And the way Hernandez later described it was that he sensed that Herzog didn't want a leader, that Herzog was a strong personality, and he wanted to set the tone for the team. But when he went to New York, it was made clear that they were looking for that from him, and he provided it.
So, chemistry.
Yeah, you know, and chemistry is, when you talk about intangibles, anybody who does and has found this, and the term that usually comes up first is chemistry, and the common remark is that, well, chemistry is what happens when a team is going good rather than vice versa. And to me, chemistry is the term that's been misused and misunderstood. People consider it to be everybody getting along and this, you know, kumbaya kind of feeling, everybody around the campfire singing songs. And that's, I mean, there might be a place for that, and that might be helpful on some occasions, but that's not what chemistry is. And you alluded to it when you said chemistry with Hernandez and the Mets. It's that right mix. It's player A providing a missing piece or a needed piece for player B, and on and on, hopefully through players K or P. But, it's much like actual chemistry. It's the mix of elements. Some elements are, you know, work in a salutary way, and they aid each other. They make each other better. Others don't. And if you bring, say Orlando Cabrera, for instance, with the Reds in 2010, made a big difference because he was a jocular kind of guy and could loosen up somebody like Joey Votto, who's very stern and severe. If you put that same happy-go-lucky player on a team that already has, say, David Ortiz and Kevin Millar and so forth, or the Red Sox, that element, although, you know, Cabrera did make a big difference on the Red Sox, but that element can be lost on a team that already has it. But it's an artsy kind of proposition. It's not scientific in a way that sabermetrics would like to view it. It's very fluid and extremely complicated.
Now, you talk about statistics a lot here in the sabermetric community. Are there too many statistics? Because I'm thinking, you talk about the ability to take an extra pitch to allow the runner to steal a base at the risk of sacrificing your own ability to hit the ball. I'm guessing some of these things can be quantified to a degree, but I wonder about, obviously there are things that
take place in the clubhouse that you obviously can't see. I mean, there's no category for most rookies bucked up in the middle of the
right,
swing, things like that.
That's a good way to put it. To your original question, no, I don't think there are too many stats, as long as they're taken in the right spirit. Analysis is information. Presumably, the more information you can gather, the better you can put it to use, the more enlightened you are. So, no, I don't think statistics can be overdone as a study, but I think as a basis for evaluation, it's the way we receive them. The times when I'm reading message boards or whatever and take issue with the sabermetric premise is usually not from the sabermetrician himself. Most of their theories and studies make a lot of sense, but it's when the followers of those studies then carry them to a degree that I think the originator, the student of the analysis, didn't intend. One simple example I always, it's easy to use on the message board that I look at. Everybody's always talking about traits for this guy or that guy, and it will come up that one player may have a .348 on base percentage, and the other has a .336, and so the argument is made that this player with the .348 is hands down better. End of story. He's the guy to go after. Well, it's just not quite that simple, and that's an oversimplification. And I'm not painting sabermetrics with that brush by any means, but sort of the difference that I raise is not in the study, but in the embrace of it to totality, in using that study as 100% relevant in the evaluation rather than 98% or 94%.
I want to read a quote from your chapter, Is It Really a Team Sport? Statistics talk about how productive a player has been, and you can expect he will be. Modern stats do that more effectively than traditional statistical bases, but no matter how deeply you core into them, they don't tell you anything about the character of the man, the winning spirit of the player, the God-given ability of that individual to impact others by his example, his work ethic, his commitment, his determination, his reliability, his consistency. Those are not statistical fields of measurement. They are observations and intuitive and instinctive fields of measure. It's more subtle in our game. And that's a quote from John Schuerholz, then the general manager of the Atlanta Braves. So this seems to be the basis of the book.
Yeah, Schuerholz was very, very helpful. I found several general manager types who shed a lot of light on the subject, Schuerholz being one of them. That was sort of the way he predicated the culture of the Braves when he took over as general manager and built upon that, starting with Terry Pendleton. Pat Gillick, the same way, in the teams he's developed, is very, very much a believer in bringing on guys who pursue winning, who understand winning, and can share with each other what it takes to win. To me, that's the basis of chemistry, or what I call teamship. The sum of all the qualities that go into being a good teammate and providing a winning essence to a ball team. It was gratifying how many general managers and even some who were known for their sabermetric approach are intrigued by this topic and can really edify it. One of the guys who I was most surprised, not as a general manager, but as a manager, was Tony La Russa, because when I spoke with him going in, he was always known for being probably the most statistical and analytical among the current managers, several years ago. And when I presented to him that the statistics can take you most of the way, he immediately stopped short and said, no, not even most of the way. And then he proceeded then to talk about how the Cardinals have built their culture on players who do things the right way, and he will really abide no other kind.
What is teamship?
Teamship is, I use it as an acronym for qualities that constitute the ideal teammate. It would be comparable to what baseball people commonly call makeup, but all the various things. I divided intangibles into two groups, the intangibles of execution, situational, I call them. That's the stuff you observe on a field, taking the extra base, hitting behind the runner, bunting, the basic fundamentals, playing hard, breaking up double plays. Those are visible to some extent, but the ones I dealt with more are what I call environmental intangibles, and those are the social attributes and qualities that players share with each other and impress upon each other in on the field and in the clubhouse, both through example, through counsel, through leadership, advice, showing how to study pictures, study videotape, all of those things together. I mean, the acronym, I could have used any qualities to make it up, not any, but any number of qualities to make it up. But for teamship, I made it a conglomerate of toughness, execution, accountability, moxie, supportiveness, history, intensity, and passion. It's what I use to describe the ideal intangible player. Derek Jeter was the guy who most represents these qualities, and so when I discussed each of the eight qualities of teamship, part of that discussion was devoted to the way Jeter exemplifies it. I use, just sort of playfully, teamship as another branch of say war, but I call it wins above replacement player teamship. That's wart, not a number, but a subjective judgment of how you think a player contributes to a winning atmosphere of a team. It would be more like a scout would judge a player's arm as a plus or a plus plus. I would think a manager or general manager in an organization would rate a player's teamship with, you know, in that same scale, plus or minus.
Now you mentioned Jeter as emblematic of teamship.
Yeah.
Do you have to be a superstar to be in that position, or can you be like a utility player instead?
Oh, no, you don't have to be. And managers, all the managers I talked to spoke of this, that their job is so much easier when the best player is also the best citizen, is your leader, and a guy whose example can show the way. I focused on the Reds to some extent, not with the exclusion of other teams, but to some extent because I'm able to observe them on television every night. And that was the dynamic at work with the Reds when I started following them for this book in 2008. That was the year they traded Ken Griffey Jr. and Adam Dunn. They're two best players, clearly. They're most popular players, best known players, and the best paid players. Because of their status, they were the leaders of a team that was otherwise pretty young. But they didn't want to be leaders. They were good guys. They were both funny. They played hard in their own way, but not in a dazzling, conspicuous, all-out manner that management would like to see the younger players adopt. And when Walt Jocketty took over as general manager, he identified the need for a culture change, and to him it started with trading Griffey and Dunn, not because they were bad eggs in the clubhouse, but because, you know, the Reds had a long streak of losing. He needed a different environment in place, and they defined the environment. And so, you know, because they really, had they been lesser players, there would probably have been not such a need to make that personnel change. A couple of the managers and general managers talked about having a sort of a critical mass, I call it, of character. When you have maybe five or six, seven players who all throw together and kind of set the tone in the clubhouse, then that culture is strong enough that if there's a player who can help you, who is not considered, you know, the best citizen, but can hit 320 with, you know, a 942 OPS, you can accommodate that player and his attitude, say, much better if that critical mass of character is already in place on your club. And certainly if you're talking about 5 to 8 players, they're not all going to be stars, but maybe veterans. Dusty Baker always said he liked a leader at every position. He wanted to see a starting pitcher, relief pitcher, a starting infielder, outfielder, and then a bench player. One leader in every category. Of course, your bench players aren't going to be stars, but the bench players, you know, usually their playing time, their sample size is much smaller, and so their statistical difference will be minimized. In which case, the intangibles that they bring to the table count much more. They come into play every day before and during a game. And so that's why the non-stars, the bench players of a team, are often kept on the roster for that reason.
Would you classify intangible as the anti-money ball?
No. I'd like to think of it as sort of taking up where Moneyball left off. You know, it doesn't really argue anything or contend against anything that was presented in Moneyball. Those are all analytics that can be demonstrated to be effective. But I think in the enthusiastic embrace of Moneyball, perhaps it sort of washed out what is a very traditional emphasis and appreciation of the little things, the subtler things, the intangibles. And so I think it's taking up where Moneyball left off. I like to see it the purpose of the book is demystifying intangibles, making them evident, concrete, making them in a way tangible, where you can identify and see that these things really do have an effect. Intangibles are, I see them as an article of faith. Everybody trusts that they make a difference, but you know, it's in the air. It's not concrete. And I think if this book can somehow demystify intangibles and make them real, then it has served its purpose. That's what I'm trying to accomplish here, to make those things real.
And the book is Intangible, The Subtle Things That Win Baseball Games. We've been talking with the author, Lonnie Wheeler. Lonnie, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Rob, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
And that was our baseball conversation with Lonnie Wheeler. Next week, we'll be taking a little departure from the usual book chat, when we'll be talking with Jerry Cohen, co-founder of Ebbets Field Flannels. So tune in again next time. Remember, if you have a question, please send to Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf at gmail.com and visit the blog, Ron Kaplan's Baseball Bookshelf, for the latest news, reviews, previews, and interviews on the national pastime and books, movies, films, etc. So long, everybody.
Boys, I'm glad I discovered this land.